Good morning. I am your host, Claudia Shambaugh, welcoming you to the January 23rd, 2018 edition of Ask a Leader. Saturday's Orange County Women's March 2018 was a very full and captivating program, long on representation of sectors and ethnicities. Remarkable high school students from Anaheim, Irvine, and Santa Ana shared the podium with Indigenous women, union representatives, UCI faculty, nonprofit CEOs, activists, elected officials, and performers. Yesterday, the Medical Humanities Initiative and the Center on Law, Equality, and Race offered a forum to Lisa Sun-Hee Park, whose work on medical deportations, an unfathomable health upon vulnerable people, both documented and undocumented, was quite the new information for most of us to take in. Keep those forums in mind if you can schedule it. Now, for today, we'll have local banking executive Tyrone DeWale cover how the federal tax overhaul affects lending practices and investments and how breathless that can keep professionals to be boning up on these changes. And we'll talk mainly about how that affects people in Orange County. Prevailing real estate trends will be of additional interest. In the second segment, Charlie Bleck will return to the show with congressional and California statewide updates from the Brady campaign for the prevention of gun violence. The Concealed Carry Reciprocity Act, House Resolution 38, passed in the House on December 6th, and it's now going to the Senate. We'll be right back after a short station break. Welcome back to Ask a Leader. Thank you, everybody, for staying tuned. My first guest today is Tyrone DeWale. He's vice president of Lend Plus, located in Aliso Viejo, here to talk about many of the new and finer points of real estate finance as the consequential U.S. tax overhaul bill, also known as the Tax Cut and Reform Bill, major and finer points we're going as they become known and understood. Ty's been involved in financial services and real estate for over 20 years. Prior to that, he was an electrical engineer at WSP, one of the largest professional firms in the world, experience which he attributes to a successful transition into the financial services field. He's been involved in numerous startup companies that went on to be successful platforms such as Greenlight Financial and Barrington Capital. He's traded with all the main investment banks on Wall Street and has issued hundreds of millions in securities of government bonds and successfully navigated, therefore survived, the financial crash of 2008. He's authorized by the Department of Housing and Urban Development, HUD, and the FHA, underwriting government mortgages, and has held real estate license for over 20 years, where he's made his home here in Orange County. He completed his education in London, the United Kingdom, at Richmond College, where he studied electronic and electrical engineering for 4 years. Today, he joins me in studio. Welcome to Ask a Leader, Tyrone DeWale.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Well, this is a big bite all professionals, financial professionals, had to chew on. I just like to know, in my earnest way, what kind of heft does it take? What kind of brain trust? How do you find out what all is in a 500-plus page tax overhaul?
Well, I feel it's going to keep CPAs and attorneys, tax attorneys, very busy for the next few months, jigging their software and their calculations. In terms of finding out what's actually in the code, it's really the average person has to understand how to read the regulations. In reading the regulations, and when you initially look at a regulation that's quoted as something like CFR 1026 section 2, it's understanding how that is derived. So if looking at trying to understand a regulation or find a section or cite a section, for example, the number 1026, you would assume that that would go to section 1026.
All numerical. Yeah, but
correct. But it's actually not. It's section 10, and say it's 26 or 24. That would be the 24th letter of the alphabet. And then it goes to subsection there. So you could easily misquote or misread something in the wrong section, thinking that you're in the right section. So that's the first of all. What was interesting also is I had written to Mimi Walters, who is
our congresswoman for the 45th.
Yeah, and yesterday evening when I arrived home, I actually received a letter back from her.
What did you ask?
Mainly was the interest deduction, opposing the reduction of that interest deduction on the mortgage interest.
Okay.
That was one of the main
points. Your
bread
and butter.
Exactly.
In financing, penciling it up for your customers.
Medical expenses deduction, I think, you know.
It's gone.
Healthcare is very important, you know, within the United States. You don't have a national health
system. So, Ty, did you use your letterhead as a financial professional, or did you use home letterhead?
Personally, it was a personal letter to them.
So. Okay. So, anyway, so you raised all those things that change. So what did she say?
She replied, she indicated the points where it is positive for the California homeowner, the average California homeowner. She indicated, obviously, that she fought hard not to eliminate the mortgage interest deduction. Obviously, it went from $1 million down to $500,000.
It wasn't $700,000.
Sorry, $750,000. Yep, they were proposing $500,000. What was interesting, she did also fight for existing homeowners where they're...
No, she said she fought for it.
Well, in her letter yesterday I received, I can quote that, she was a significant improvements in the bill where the existing homeowner would maintain their interest deduction, where the reduction in the interest deduction would be applied to new purchases.
So, shoving people in the market where they may not be intending to
exactly,
go.
Exactly, exactly.
Okay.
Some of the other areas which were positive for a California individual would be the deduction of medical expenses. So, if that exceeds 10% of the individual's income, that the bill increases the deduction to 7.5%, increases it by 7.5%. So there's some good points to the tax code. If you look at the seven brackets of the tax code, and I'm not sure whether your listeners have actually looked into the brackets of the tax code.
Well, it depends, because we're all looking at a lot of things at once. It's kind of fatiguing.
It is. But on average, for a single filer, the seven brackets, you're saving somewhere between about 2 to 3% reduction in your taxes. So there's a saving there as an individual. Married filing jointly, you're looking somewhere at least in some cases of 4 to 6% because of the change in the bracket. So I would advise the listeners to actually look at the tax brackets, see where you're slotted in. So for example, somebody who was making in excess of $480,000 in the old tax bracket, now they would be slotted into the 35% tax bracket. So the 30
for the marginal tax.
Yes, right. Married filing. So the higher end, there's significant savings. There's not so much for the individual filer, average worker.
Right, but everybody's looking over at the tax tally, and this is not really your purview to sort of balance out the whole household, sort of shift share of federal support of each household. But when you cut the revenue into the U.S. Treasury, there are services that you're counting on that are going away, and so it's tax cuts offset by service loss. So the household budget is, let's be honest, it's not that beneficial as things start to go away when we're starting to underwrite, paying for the tax deficit debt service and all those kinds of things. So I want us all we've got lots of columns. It's not just the tax liabilities.
Correct. I mean, obviously an increase in the debt, and therefore
the debt service payoff
that puts it really on the shoulders of the youngsters of the country, going forward. So,
yeah.
Obviously if you can't service your debt, what do you end up doing at the end of the day? Raising taxes to pay the service on the debt. So even though this is an immediate tax cut for the population today, if you're looking at 5-10 years down the road, there could be obviously a tax increase to service that debt.
So let's talk then about your customers that are coming in. They had some assumptions about how much house they were going to be able to afford and how much of a mortgage they were going to carry. So you're having to work with them to adjust to we were talking about the mortgage deduction. So they're going to have to pay a if they can find it, they have to pay a larger down payment before to bring their whole mortgage down.
Yeah,
if they can.
If they have the funds, obviously KUCI University, probably many of the listeners are millennials, as well as working professionals.
But there's not that money, yeah. They're paying a loan off for students.
Yeah, the student loans really has been a burden on the millennials. So the homeownership rate for millennials has not increased as expected because of the student loans.
It's not
loans.
Dropping off?
Plateau tabling? Stagnant.
Okay.
The millennials tend to have been more educated on the homeownership program. Lenders are reaching out to millennials on how to qualify. Fannie and Freddie have eased some of the qualification areas for homeowners.
Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac,
which trickles down to lenders. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac do not issue loans. It's the lender issues the loan, then that's securitized and sold back to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and put into bonds. But with regard to qualification for a loan, it actually has become slightly easier in the last few months. Fannie and Freddie have eliminated some of the barriers. For example, they increased the debt ratio coverage. So before, they would cap you at 45% of your income, gross income, to go towards qualifying for your mortgage plus any other credit liabilities. That has increased to 50%. Some of the first-time home buyer programs have made it easier for borrowers as well. Both Fannie and Freddie have come up with a 3% down program to compete with FHA. It does have mortgage insurance, but the cost and overall effect is slightly cheaper than an FHA loan, and the mortgage insurance can be eliminated after a certain time, whereas unlike an FHA loan, it cannot.
Wow. There is a financial lesson for all of us. It's dawning for me. For those of you who've just joined us, my guest for this portion of the hour is Tyrone Doyle. He's vice president of Lend Plus, which is a mortgage firm in Elisa Viejo, and I should give him a chance to talk about just how diverse, I don't know, do you call it your portfolio or your range of services in investments, investment properties, residences, and all kinds of things. So I should give you a chance to talk about what you're doing.
Yeah, so at Lend Plus, we provide financing for first-time home buyers, investment properties, single-family, four units, multifamily. We have a partner for commercial loans if that's required, but the majority of our business is for purchases or home refinances. So we provide FHA, VA, regular loans for the average Joe, and also we provide jumbo loans, $2-4 million loans as well.
So the changes, well, let me just go back to whether you were privy to, we know that the real estate lobbyists around the country, they were all over this legislation. So were you privy to what the lenders were, their involvement were in this tax overhaul legislation?
We received information back from the MBA, the Mortgage Bankers Association.
So, and what were they coming out and saying?
So they
or were they different from different states? It mattered.
Well, it's from all over the states, but obviously California and the East Coast states. The tax code has a bigger implication
right.
for those states because the home price is a lot higher. Obviously, the mortgage interest deduction is very important. So they were trying to preserve that mortgage interest deduction. Some of the data that had been received from, for example, the National Association of Realtors had predicted properties, home prices to decrease by 4%, home sales for existing home sales to drop to 2.9%, a decline in inventory, people holding off listing their home. So that was the prediction there from the National Association of Realtors. Some of the other data provided was, for example, what it means for a real estate professional in himself as an individual. Definitely for people that are commissioned income, their tax liabilities have been definitely reduced by at least 40-50%. Depending on each situation. For example, if somebody
yes.
receives a real estate commission, say $45,000, they've got personal exemptions, itemized deductions. So in that example, in the prior law, he would have been paying about, on that commission, $5,358 tax. That has been reduced to $2,400. So that's a 50% decrease in his tax liability. Depends where he puts that money at the end of the day. I'm saving on tax. Is he going to be spending more in the local economy and creating jobs? So that's in just one particular case.
Yeah. So you're talking about like the real estate people in sales, real estate professionals, but you're a real estate professional because you're lending.
Correct, so, correct.
But it's a different thing. You're not dealing with commissions. You're dealing with the percentages for, well, the interest, how much interest.
Yeah, so I think overall, qualifying for a mortgage, you're qualifying off your gross income, not your net. So they're looking at your gross income. Me as an individual coming from a different country, I always thought that was
slightly crazy
when I first arrived in the industry, because you don't pay with your gross income. Obviously, you're paying with your net.
Exactly. But, oh, that must have been a rude awakening here. I don't know if we know that. That I don't understand that is the principle, but okay.
Yeah, so it's gross. Obviously, with the Dodd-Frank Act, there were some changes in terms of residual income is now required on the majority of loans. There is a requirement.
What do you mean by residual income for us financial illiterates?
Yes, after you pay your mortgage, your homeowner's insurance, your taxes and insurance, you look at the family size, and therefore it has to be a minimum residual income, let's say, for example, of approximately $800 for a family of four. They have to have at least $800 left over after taking into account their debts, depending on its West Coast, East Coast, each area is different.
Mm-hmm. Right.
One area of lending where common sense does prevail was actually the VA. So the VA takes into account your net income, and it requires residual income, whereas conventional loans, Fannie, Freddie, FHA, calculate your qualifying ratios off of your gross income.
Wow, that's staggering.
But we all know we pay bills with our net income.
Oh, my. Yes, that's right. Wow. So how is it then? Let's take a look at the market. So you're now four weeks into when this tax has taken effect. So are there any stories?
It's very early. It's very early. So I'm not even sure if people have seen the effect on their paychecks yet. I mean, you have...
Are there less phone calls, emails coming in because people are waiting and looking it over?
Yeah, well, we're coming up to a period of time, I think, for the industry. There's two areas that hit us. It's post-Christmas, so some have credit card debt.
Yeah, yeah.
We're coming into tax season. It's a slow time of year. So this time of year is fairly slow. People are preparing or could be preparing their homes for the summer explosion, as so to speak, to sell the home in the peak time. So it's really too early to tell at this moment in time what is happening. Obviously, within the news, you're hearing companies providing, taking that tax saving and providing
putting
that
in
back.
A bonus, bonuses. A one time only.
Yes. KFC was on the radio this morning.
Okay.
They hadn't made a decision about the bonuses. It's a heavily franchised business. So therefore, you've got individual owners to decide to do that. But some of the larger companies are setting the trend to give back to the employees. So, $2,000 can go towards a down payment.
Okay, that's true. So there's not many stories yet coming in then. And LendPlus is based, it's national, no?
We're in seven states. We're adding states monthly. Obviously, there's a great expense to add additional states. Then it's also finding qualified salespeople that can do businesses in each state. So the Dodd-Frank Act has, in my personal opinion, definitely increased the cost to the homeowner at the end of the day. Because we have all these regulations, we have to update our software to comply and be legally compliant with these regulations. For example, there's one company had spent $10 million, a bank, on programming their systems to keep up with Dodd-Frank. They had 100,000 man hours on programming. So if you take 100,000 man hours and the average programmer costs $60 to $150 per hour, depending on the skill level, that's a significant cost. Now, who pays that at the end of the day? The consumer.
Yes. Well, with the lack of protections in legislation like that, we're talking a different cost. Lack of transparency, insolvency, and those kind of things that can just create bankruptcy situations, which is a heck of a lot more expensive than a per transaction expense.
Well, yeah, so I suppose that comes back to pre-Dodd-Frank,
right?
Wall Street greed.
Yep, yep, yep.
And where we ended up in the economy. But they threw the baby out with the bathwater, in my opinion, because the horse had already left the stable. So
it's a lot of collisions.
Yeah. Okay. So, for example, the whole securities industry came to a halt and froze. You couldn't securitize any loans at that point during the crash. And therefore, the appetite for investors all over the world to buy U.S. bonds had dwindled down to basically zero. So some of the regulations, the industry had self-regulated. And I tend not to agree with self-regulation, but pension fund, hedge fund managers, they don't want to buy those type of bonds. So the industry had moved in itself to self-regulate. And then you had the lawmakers coming, and it was just complete over-regulation and burdensome on regulation. So obviously there needs to be some protection, as I said earlier, with the ability to pay is required, gross versus net income. Okay.
Right.
The regulation with Dodd-Frank now requires the ATR, the ability to repay within the regulation. But there's some areas where, you know, if you receive a quote from a lender and the lender decides to benefit your situation, something happens in the market, and let's say, for example, you know, your interest rate is 4% and they're charging you $1,000. Something shifts in the market and they say, oh, you know what, today actually we can give you a credit back to that. There's a time factor that we have to allow for.
And then it's gone.
And then it's gone. But
okay.
But the extra days are an added cost. So, for example, why can't I give you a benefit immediately and not have to wait 3, 4, 7, 10 days in order to consummate that transaction?
Well, I just have to say, with the kinds of assets, the kind of capital available to the pension and hedge funds, they could have done a lot better job with putting out what kind of good neighbors they could be in what ways, instead of, you know, trying to rig outcomes for the top 0.5% in legislation, couldn't they?
I mean, where were they? I think they were counting their bonus checks.
Right. So that's the thing.
Yeah, I mean, within real estate now, for home ownership being definitely in Southern California being very expensive, and if you look at, you know, youngsters today, qualifying for a mortgage is more difficult. They have student loans. They've got to come up with a larger down payment. Will that drive people out of California? Basically, it shuts them out of home ownership, makes them into a class of renters. And now you have moving in the market. I was just reading up on this. Some hedge funds opening up real estate services where they will actually buy your home from you, cut out the real estate individual, then hold that home, raise the rents, and rent that out. So you have homeowners saying, okay, I don't wish to pay 6% commission, you know, 3% to one agent to sell it, to list it, and 3% to bring me a buyer, or 2.5, 2.5. They're doing it for as little as 1%. So now you could have a situation where you have these huge hedge funds with their apps buying up chunks of real estate and taking that off the market and raising prices. And therefore, now you've left, and now they control the rents. So you have a complete monopoly of the housing market.
That is what, when you and I talked about this before, in which we have, folks, that is a consolidation of ownership issue that really rattles my cage. Is, are we, all of us, I think it's off most people's radar that an increasing amount of real estate commodities are, the ownership of them is being concentrated under a smaller and smaller number of parties owning them. And so there will be a higher rent exacted. People are less able to leave the rental market and move into their homeowners, essentially. So to what extent is that happening in Orange County, Ty?
Obviously, the two favorite markets are New York, and I say LA, West Coast, Orange County.
LA Basin, yeah. We can say, yeah.
And so this, I wouldn't call it phenomenon, but this business idea, it's definitely gaining traction. I don't have any significant numbers yet on where, how many units have been sold in these two areas. But on my next visit, I'll pull some data. I'll get together with the California Association of Realtors and National Association of Realtors and see what impact that has and how many transactions have occurred. But the trouble with people and consumers is that we're all into saving money at the end of the day, but it's almost like, you know, chewing your own foot off, right? You're eating yourself from the inside out. So if you take a company like Uber, you know, Uberizing the taxi industry, it's great for the consumer.
For a moment, until?
Until they monopolize the market and then they charge what they want, you know.
Right, because it's now subsidized. Uber's subsidizing every single ride, and then eventually the true cost will be there, and then there's only one person running all those. Well, let's go back to the California Association of Realtors. They've got skin in this game. If the hedge funds are creating their own real estate kind of service internally, that's a smaller share of real estate market for the Association of Realtors to be participating in.
Yeah, so with NAR, the acronyms NAR, National Association of Realtors, and CAR, you will see them fight these two new business ideas.
Right. They'll want to regulate that.
Regulate that. They'll probably go for the monopolistic area in terms of regulating those areas. I mean, Uber, for example, different country in right now, Uber in London, they've lost their license in London. So even though they have billions of dollars behind them, the same as the hedge funds with these new real estate opportunities and doing everything cheaper, but it does provide a monopolistic area for those large hedge funds. So CAR and NAR would definitely be fighting against that and looking at the interest of their members as well as the public. Because buying real estate is not so easy as selling real estate. So having a professional advise you and really being hands-on is very important than having an app on your phone, unless you know what you're doing.
Right. Well, I mean, that's what I think everybody's home ownership experience was, that what became a rather personalized relationship with their broker, their agent.
The broker, their agent.
There's a real added value to that aspect that
That's
you're
great.
Saying won't take place with that hedge fund's real estate service entity.
I have a saying. It's insurance is always expensive until you need it. Sometimes it pays you to pay slightly more for the service than going for something cheaper.
Well, wouldn't Dodd-Frank also be a similar adage?
I think so. I mean, I look at it two ways. I look at it from my industry and as an individual consumer. And during the boom times, I was privy to what was going on in other companies. And it was complete mayhem and robbery of the public. And so the companies that I was involved with, we were very concerned about the ability to repay. We did provide, no doc loans, no income, no asset, no employment. You're just lending off credit score. But at the end of the day, we always required bank statements from that consumer to cash flow. Now, they didn't actually make it into the end product, but we knew that there was an ability to repay. So we prided ourselves on the quality of the production that we produce from consumers. And I can't say that for most of the other companies that went under. New Century and Option One and those.
Right, companies. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, that's exactly what I was thinking about there. Well, if you've just joined us today on this part of the show, it's Tyrone DeWale. He's with Len Plus. His office is in Aliso Viejo, but he's talked about that it is doing business in seven different states and growing here on Ask a Leader at KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine, streaming on the web all over the world at KUCI.org. And we're on all those social media platforms, Twitter, Instagram, Tumblr, Facebook. Just look for KUCI and you'll pull up the whole name, the whole handle there. So it's a privilege to have an enlightened, a progressive lending professional come and answer all our wide-eyed financial questions today. I don't know if there's any additional we ought to have on our radar, because our attentions are diverted to so many shiny objects and so many dreadful consequential policy matters. What other trends should we be watching for, Ty?
Well, I feel that past history is a good indication of the future, and what is happening is on the East Coast and West Coast, there is a softening of the high-end real estate. So prices are tending to drop. And if you look at the past two recessions, those are the areas that indicated the first decline in residential real estate, and that trickled down. So if you're looking to where the market is headed, you're looking for a drop in the very, very high-end real estate. And
right. That's, we didn't get to that.
Yeah,
the changes in the market. Okay, so at that level, there'll be a drop adjusting so that, because it's fewer people are going to be able to use their mortgage deduction as part of the whole penciling out for their available eligibility to buy that real estate.
Exactly. Yes, exactly. So you have that area softening and that trickles down to the mid-level, and therefore that trickles down to the average consumer, in a condo, one-bedroom condo.
So the middle level, then there's more demand in that section, so the price is going to be driven up, so it's going to sort of push over into the area, but not quite. I guess there's a ceiling to how much then that middle level, more competitive, heating up market would be.
Well, you have that, and also you have a rising interest rate environment as well. Yep. So the rising interest rate environment doesn't help as well. So you have a softening there. And in addition, in some of the more investment banking areas, predictions are in 24 months, we're looking at a slight turn down and a recession. So the famous chap, Ray Dalio, who runs Bridgewater Capital, largest hedge fund in the world, he's rode out the last two recessions very well, didn't lose any money. But this morning he was actually in Davos in Switzerland.
Right, convening today.
Convening today. And again, he's in the camp of a recession in the next 24 months, towards the end of the 24 months. So, you know, it will be now behoove people to start preparing for, you know, a downturn. Rather than be spending, be saving.
Right on schedule. A Republican presidency always. Watch, folks, there's always a recession. The midterm of the Republican presidency.
Yeah, towards the next election.
And that's what he's saying.
Exactly.
But it's more structural, you're saying, because of adjustments with the Federal Reserve allowing interest rates to increase.
That and interest rates increasing, and also the waning of people, you know, they were talking about the other week, China stopping buying the U.S. Treasury debt. So, you know, you have a whole global phenomenon.
All the way around the Pacific Rim, too?
Correct.
They're all pulling back.
Correct. House prices in London have decreased as well. So they're on the decline. So you have two major cities.
But that's structural with Brexit.
With Brexit, but also you have the foreign buyers driving up prices too high. The locals can't afford it. And you have the same here in California, New York. So you definitely have a softening of the real estate market. And the real estate market definitely provides, you know, figures I recall correct. If somebody buys a single family home in California, that adds about $57,000 per transaction into the local economy. So
really?
Yeah. So you have $57,000 per unit into the local economy, you have a softening of the economy, and therefore not as many real estate transactions occurring, and therefore $57,000 per transaction disappears from the economy.
So those are all the fees everybody pays, and what else?
It's not fees. It's relative to you buy a new house, you need a washing machine,
durable goods,
et cetera, et cetera. So it's estimated about
hiring. People that are making more improvements inside and outside.
Inside, gardeners, painting, window blinds, et cetera, et cetera.
Okay.
Yeah.
Plus fees. Well, good. Well, thank you. It's a real pleasure, and I'm glad you're giving us an opportunity to revisit where some of these trends are taking us when the country dusts off the holidays and the new Federal Reserve sorts of policies kick in, and after Davos and all these other things that we can come back and talk about what we ought to be facing here in Orange County.
Definitely. In the next couple of months, let's revisit this and see where we end up and see where the consumer is kind of heading towards. And hopefully interest rates will remain competitive and people can buy homes.
Well, Ty the Whale, Vice President of Capital Markets at LendPlus, located in Alicia View. Ty, thank you so much for coming to Ask Leader. Thanks for taking the time coming to join me in studio today.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you all. We'll be back after a station break with Charles Bleck, board member of the Orange County chapter of the Brady Campaign for the Prevention of Gun Violence. We've got lots of updates. Be right back. Don't go away. The inestimable Ahmad Jamal. Thanks for staying tuned. Welcome back to the show. My next guest is Charles Bleck, founder and president of the Orange County chapter of the Brady Campaign, Center for the Prevention of Gun Violence. He's been honored for his work by Loyola Law School, Law Center to Prevent Gun Violence, Brady Center to Prevent Gun Violence, Violence Prevention Coalition Orange County. And I always like to mention when he's on his article, our Second Amendment was published by the American Bar Association. Charles, along with his wife, Mary Lay, they've provided testimony before local, state, and federal legislative hearings and committees, and have been honored by various activist groups, among several. So Charles is going to post us today on many updates amidst so much news to keep track of. It's fatiguing, folks. I admit it to you. So Charles comes to us today from Laguna Hills. Welcome back to Ask a Leader, Charlie Bleck.
Thank you, Claudia. It's my pleasure.
Well, so much is happening in the body politic with the tsunami of high-stakes issues washing up around us. At the Women's March last Saturday, as comprehensive as the program was, I'm trying to recall whether gun violence prevention came up, although activists like yourselves were turning out then Saturday there.
We were asked to participate in the march, and we gladly did so. So, yes, we were an active part of, even though we were not speakers, we had a very warm welcome with the folks who were at the march.
Yes, indeed. And as I saw some of you out there, and the banners, and but as I was saying, there's so much to cover, and there are such consequential laws being now debated in on the national front, where we're going to talk about the ironies here of federal and state kinds of rights issues going on as it plays out with the with gun control. So let's begin. We talked about it when Mary Lee and you were both on the show last time, that since then, the reciprocity legislation, that's House Resolution 38, that passed on December 7th, it was sort of put on hold, and then boom, it was passed when people were perhaps diverted. Let's talk about the reciprocity legislation once again, just in a sort of shorthand, Charles, and then what you think is going to play out on the U.S. Senate floor with voting on this.
Well, first of all, your listeners need to know that this particular bill is an absolutely horrendous bill, which will undermine our strong California laws. In California, we have something called a May issue as far as carrying concealed loaded weapons. So that you have to go before law enforcement, there's training, there's fingerprinting, there's background checks. We want to keep dangerous weapons out of dangerous hands. Our four Republican Congress people from this county, Issa, Walters, Royce, and Rohrabacher, not only signed on as co-authors of H.R. 38, but they all voted yes in support of it. You also need to understand that there are a number of states that call themselves constitutional carry states where they do not require any standards at all. I mean, domestic abusers, people with criminal records, they can make application. It's a shall issue state. They get their particular concealed weapon permit, and under this particular federal law, they would be allowed to legally carry a loaded hidden gun on our streets and in our communities. That's just plain wrong. Fortunately, in the Senate, It still takes 60 votes to bring it to the floor.
Oh.
And at this point, we do have that particular bill blocked. But it's a tremendously dangerous bill. California State Police Chiefs Association, in a letter dated July 13th, and our California State Sheriffs Association, in a letter dated May 22nd of 2017, both strongly denounced this bill, yet these Republican office holders are going along with the NRA-backed. And it's just a real shame.
So that's the thing with the states' rights, that the irony of those who, that support it in the Senate, there's a hidden hand involved with the consolidated power of the NRA that overrides that philosophy.
I think it's ironic, as you say, Claudia, that Republicans have a platform that talks about state rights. However, we're talking about a federal mandate here that would override our strong California law. And that's completely ignoring the 10th Amendment that I hear time and again is important to the Republican Party. It's a real flip-flop, and it's not only a flip-flop, but it's a dangerous flip-flop, which will create havoc. You need to understand that the NRA likes to tell us that an armed society is a polite society, but John Donahue from Stanford University did substantial research, and he found that in right-to-carry states, they are associated with substantial increases in the rates of aggravated assault, rape, robbery, and even murder. That was a Stanford report, November of 2014. So what they are doing is they're creating not only havoc of our laws, but they're endangering our citizens. And why? Just to please a certain special interest group. That's just plain wrong.
Now, besides that, there to watch at, and you're saying that there's a requirement of 60 votes to support the vote going to the floor. How tenuous, though? I mean,
yeah,
to the floor of the Senate. So, how tenuous is
right,
that?
Right now, we have right now we have that block. And fortunately, Senator Feinstein and Senator Harris are strong advocates in opposition to this particular bill. There's also a bill in the Senate that is Senate Bill 446, and it isn't even getting a hearing. So the Senate really has no appetite for this bill. But you know what? We have to be vigilant, and we have to keep the pressure up. And if your listeners have people who are in other states, then by golly, they need to know this. And most importantly, we have a really significant election coming up in November, and we have two of the four folks that supported this particular measure in the House that have already decided not to run for re-election. We aren't going to have Issa or Royce available, and we need to not only allow whoever takes their place not to support something like this, but we need to hold Mimi Walters and Rohrabacher accountable for their reckless votes.
Well, I want eyes over here, meaning I want them on June 5th for the primary, since especially in California, that since the two top vote-getters, regardless of party, advance to the general, the show is on in June before we even get to the big show in November. So I'm going to always push everybody back the calendar up to June so we know.
I agree. Thank you very much. I agree with you. I still have to get used to the new election law, but wouldn't that be something if we had all four of those folks not even be on the ballot come November?
Well, I mean, we live in interesting times, and so that's where I noticed that still a lot of people aren't aware of how that works, so I'm going to keep reminding people. And then that was actually with the Women's March last Saturday. That was a total lost opportunity that nothing was really mentioned about the primary, so we'll just keep talking about that, you and I and the rest of us.
Right.
And
Claudia, there's one other really important new law that we have in California that's apparently going to be replicated in a half a dozen other states this coming year, and that's the gun violence restraining order that I'd like to take a moment and make your listeners aware of.
Yes, yes, yes.
The unfortunate shooting in Santa Barbara a couple of years ago where the family knew that their son was in crisis and they knew there was going to be some type of tragedy, and they were even in transit to Santa Barbara to intervene when he went off and he killed six different people and many people were injured. We now have a law effective January 1 of 2016, and a lot of people don't know about it. It's like if a tree falls in the forest and no one's there, doesn't make a noise. Well, we want to make noise. First of all, it is a civil matter, not a criminal matter. Second of all, it's an application where you go to civil court, the person is in crisis, either a family member or law enforcement can make the application. We get an immediate 21-day order. It's not a personal restraining order. It specifically says we're going to remove the guns from the crisis situation. So we're going to take dangerous weapons out of potentially dangerous hands for a minimum of 21 days, and then there'll be another hearing where the restraining order may be extended where they cannot have possess or buy ammunition or guns. The bottom line is that when I was at UCI and there was this rally for solidarity after the Santa Barbara shooting, I was so upset with the coordinators because they didn't want to talk about solutions. They didn't want to talk about prevention. It was, oh, we're just going to stand in solidarity. Well, solidarity is nice, but by golly, we now have a law where we can prevent this from happening at UCI or any other potential campus. The bottom line is be vigilant. Take a look. Know who your people are. Know what their mood is. Young people, and I'm going to be 73 next year, so I guess I get to use the term young people, can be extremely emotional. It goes up and down. The bottom line is be vigilant. Be aware of the emotions of your friends. We can take and remove these guns in a civil matter. It's not criminal. It's civil, and we can prevent these types of tragedies from occurring. So we have a tool now through law enforcement or family members to make an appropriate application and remove the gun from the dangerous potential situation. We need to be aware of it. There are forms at the local courthouse. They're very simple to fill out, and they're going to be life-saving.
For those of you just joined us, my guest is Charles Bleck. He's board member, president, actually founding member of the Orange County chapter of the Brady Campaign for the Prevention of Gun Violence, dedicated to the prevention of gun deaths and injuries. We're talking about pending legislation and where exactly is the restraining order law being adopted around the country outside of the California where it started?
I was afraid you were going to ask that, Claudia.
We'll pick that up later. Well, so then let's go back up to the national arena where the silencer legislation, and I don't know, I have a sort of a thin skin for how euphemistically some of these things are entitled. It's called, folks, the Sportsman Heritage and Recreational Enhancement Act, and they get to call it the SHARE Act or the Hearing Protection Act. It's, I think, a favor to the son of the man occupying the White House, the silencer legislation. So where on earth is that moving through Congress?
Well, what was interesting is it was scheduled for a hearing in committee the same morning that we had that shooting for the Republicans who were practicing for their softball game against the Democrats. And by golly, it got canceled, that particular hearing. You're talking about H.R. 367, the Hearing Protection Act, and Senate 59, they call themselves also the Hearing Protection Act. And the key here is that basically we've been able to convince people that this is not an appropriate bit of legislation. California, we already banned silencers. But more importantly, you need to understand with this bill that silencers do not make the gun silent. Instead, they alter and disperse the sound of gunfire, and it makes it harder for law enforcement and bystanders to both immediately identify the sound as gunshots and also to identify where the sound is coming from. So again, it's a very dangerous particular bit of legislation, and we have to trace why is this being introduced now other than the president's son as an advocate. Well, silencers are not inexpensive, so we have to follow the money trail. And we have to understand that the gun industry, regardless of our public safety and health, will do what they need to do to try and increase their profit margin.
Well, one thing I was, you know, I guess I shouldn't have been shocked, but I guess just a little rudely informed about recently. I don't know that any of us have connected this, but I guess we shouldn't be surprised. The aspect of the National Rifle Association getting funds from Russian sources. What on earth is that about?
I just hope that I am so pleased that the Federal Bureau of Investigation is going after that particular pipeline. The problem we've always had with the NRA is it's not a public corporation, so we've always had to just guess about their financing and their source of funds. And recently, when the gun manufacturer reps have taken over the board so that even members of the NRA who are 80 and 90% in favor of our particular types of legislation, like universal background checks, are blocking these things from coming to a vote. It's amazing that they report $30 million going into the campaign, but we've heard reports of upwards of $60 to $70 million. And the NRA just does not have that kind of resource to channel that kind of money in from its own membership.
Wow.
I am really very curious and looking forward to a thorough report from our FBI about that. Because bottom line is, taking money from a foreign power like that and channeling it into our election is absolutely illegal.
Well, I guess there's so many ironies we just could die of them. Were the membership aware of the alignment with a place where they pretty much, you know, considered themselves at odds with, that now it's in concert with working with them on sort of monopolizing the power around gun legislation? And I mean, and NRA is important because they've made it totally unpolitically allowed to put money into the Center for Disease Control to do research on gun violence's impact on public health. So it just reaches everywhere, that kind of funding.
What was important was way back in 1996, the NRA was smart enough to see where the tobacco industry problems were going.
Right.
And they were actually controlled the appropriations process in the House of Representatives. And they put together a censure situation, which CDC now is no longer able to really investigate and put together statistics on gun violence and violence prevention. And that's what we need. We need to have these particular hardcore statistics so we can make reasonable and appropriate recommendations and create laws that will protect all of us. And it just is a protection of a gun industry that of an industry that, for some reason, has this particular status, and they don't deserve it.
So I guess I'm going to, it's like a lightning round of things that we didn't get a chance to talk about. The departure of Sheriff Hutchins, what that impact that's going to have, do you think, on gun provision?
It depends on who runs for the office. The problem with Sheriff Hutchins is the way she flip-flopped like a fresh fish out of water when it came to the CCW permitting process, and the way she misinterpreted what the Ninth Circuit was doing. And it was important that she had two or three different ways of, well, we can't do permitting now, and then she spent $1.5 million on rushing through permits. And what was really interesting was the sheriff of San Diego County, who was the actual defendant
right.
in the Peruta case, never changed his procedure.
Right.
And she was just all over the map saying, well, the law changed, well, it didn't change, well, it's back again. And she was wrong every which way. So, quite frankly, I'm very pleased that she's retiring.
Well, we got to be careful what's in the works. We never...
In my humble opinion, wow. It can't be any worse than what we suffered through with her.
So we've got some work pending on how the Prop 63 dealing with the backlog of gun ownership of unqualified persons, that backlog, it was covered by the L.A. Times, I believe, over Sunday, the newspaper.
I am so pleased that we passed Prop 63. It covered a number of areas where there were loopholes. I was had an opportunity to be a presenter to our California State Judges Association. They meet once a year, and they lamented the fact that when they make orders telling people they have to turn over guns, they don't know whether those orders are actually followed through or not. And one of the seven items in Prop 63 was a mandate that they have to show a sales receipt to their probation officer who turns it into the court so we know that that particular order is followed up. Part of Prop 63 also was requiring somebody to report a lost or stolen gun within 5 days, because what happens is these crime guns would show up and we would trace it to the original purchaser, who would say, oh, I haven't seen that gun in a year or two. I must have lost it, or it was stolen, or whatever. All of these particular loopholes, it's fantastic. Now we have to get the state legislature to fund the ability to have agents go out and enforce Prop 63 and give local law enforcement the money to make it happen, because we're going to be removing these particular weapons from dangerous felons and so on, people who originally were able to have the gun legally but then afterwards didn't. And we have an apps program which can identify these people. We just have to go out and have the money to create the enforcement.
All right. We've got marching orders galore, and we're counting on the BLEX and some of their up-and-coming board members to keep us posted, because it's this, as I said, this public policy crisis fatigue is settling in on too many of us. We're relying on you experts to tell us what's going on there. So, Charlie,
let's keep a keen eye on June and then November, because I think this year is going to be a very pivotal year in moving forward and making substantial progress in keeping our community safe.
Amen for that. Charles Black, thank you for coming back on Ask a Leader today. I hope you'll be back with us the moment you want us to post us on what might be moving quickly through Congress.
Claudia, we will keep you posted right up to the minute, and thank you for all that you do to keep your listeners aware of this very vital and life-saving situation.
With the Blex, with so much skin in this game, folks, and I've told you about it before. We do this for Matthew, always in our thoughts. Thank you so much, Charlie, for being on the show today.
Well, thank you, Claudia. I appreciate the opportunity.
Charles Black is a board member and the founding member and still president of the Orange County chapter of the Brady Campaign for the Prevention of Gun Violence, dedicated to paring down these gun deaths and injuries. I'm going to close out the show with a couple of announcements. Professor Richard Epstein of New York University Law School and the University of Chicago will visit the Center for Biotechnology and Global Health Policy on Thursday here at the law school, January 25th at noon, to present a work in progress, The Nature of the Religious Firm. His research focuses on constitutional law, tort law, property rights, and communications law. As always in this series, they throw in a nice lunch. That's Thursday, and it's at 12 noon to 1:15 at the law school, building education room 1111. Well, that's my wrap. For next week, I'm going to have Tekle Welda Michael. He's an academic and a neighbor. He'll be my guest for the whole hour. An Eritrean national who's made America as great as ever has a book coming out soon on post-liberation Eritrea, and he's ready to surface with some privileged insights from the continent so disparaged by the man occupying the White House. Talk with you next week. Thank you, everyone, for listening.